Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, at the Reformed Forum headquarters. Deep in the center of our office, we have this little cave where I keep my books and my cameras and my microphones. And I have with me today a dear friend we have coming from up north, over the border from Wisconsin. We have Reverend Brian DeYoung, who serves as the pastor of Grace OPC in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. He also serves as a member of the committee for the historian for the OPC. Welcome, Brian. It's great to have you back down here.
Thank you. It's nice to be down here.
You were able to visit, I think, the first time you were on these premises were for our course on Machen with Daryl Hart. Mm-hmm. It wasn't an open course, but it's open to you. So we certainly had a good time, and you stayed over for a little bit.
And I've been listening to that. I've been listening to the podcast version.
Me too.
That's a great course. Let me just plug that course. That wonderful stuff.
I liked it better than listening to it on the MP3. I mean, I'm obviously, while Daryl was here, we had a wonderful time. But recording it, you're always thinking about things. At least for me, you know, I've got a million things in my head trying to make sure everything's working. And certainly it was. I listened to the podcast like everyone else, or watched it. Certainly people can go online at reformedforum.org and sign up for the course, take it for free. It's all available in video. We want more and more churches, especially, and small groups to use the course to learn. And we have companion resources that go along with it, handouts, discussion questions, all that sort of thing is available entirely for free. But we also have an MP3 version that just concluded on Monday. It was the last lesson that went out in the main Reformed Academy feed, and we're going to be launching a new course soon on that feed as well. So there are many, many ways that people can access the material. We want to meet you where you are. If you want to listen to it on your commute, there it's for you. If you want to watch it at home, there it's for you. If you want to watch it in a Sunday school setting, it's there for you. And if you've got any questions about that, you can send us an email. We'll help you out. But I don't know, what was most surprising to you about that class, or what did you find most interesting?
Well, I mean, Hart's knowledge of the cultural moment is just so deep and thorough. Mm-hmm. And I think he really puts Machen into his context in a very helpful way. I also think it's interesting that Daryl is willing to be critical, but not in a negative or caustic way. But he won't just rubber stamp anything and everything.
Yeah.
And he takes, you know, a good true historian's position of being an objective outside observer. And obviously he's very sympathetic, but I really felt like it was a benefit. In fact, we're going to use it for our adult Sunday school class in the spring. So
I enjoyed it so much. We've used one lesson. We had one of those moments. And this is partly why Reformed Academy can be helpful. Not that I'm overtly trying to give a pitch here, but we had one of those moments where the Sunday school teacher was going to be gone for a week on a business trip or vacation or something. And everyone else was already teaching some other class. Yeah. So the question is, well, what are we going to do for adult Sunday school? And we're like, this is when you pull one out of the hat.
Plug and play.
Plug and play a lesson. Exactly. So we watched the introduction and people had a great response to it. So I'm hoping that will whet enough appetites where they'll want to watch the rest of the course.
Well, you know, this is something which I found in our church. Our ruling elders find it so comfortable to do a series like this, where they can do a little bit of introduction, play the video, lead some questions and discussion afterwards, and they don't find it intimidating.
Right.
And, you know, my guys don't have a ton of time to be preparing original lessons. Mm-hmm. So this is a way for ruling elders or deacons or other men in the church to get an opportunity to teach in a small group setting, which I think is so valuable.
Yeah, it's almost like training wheels. I don't mean that, you know, condescendingly. That's a good thing where you might find a guy who's really nervous or you know, feels like he's not qualified or prepared, but he's willing to try this out. And sometimes people, they grow in their giftedness and then their confidence. And it can be a useful way for people to develop into you know, teachers who might one day want to do stuff on original material.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. So we've got a lot of things we want to talk about today. Our context is history, of course, but we want to speak specifically about the state of Wisconsin and speaking about the history of Presbyterianism there. This is something Brian and I have talked about in months past and years past, and it's something that is certainly a research interest to our guest today, Brian DeYoung. But we are going to dive in a little bit deeper. I was just up in Sheboygan in the fall doing a little bit on Ned Stonehouse for the Reformation Day Conference, but I was able to listen to a Sunday school lesson that Brian taught on significant Presbyterians in Wisconsin. And we're going to bring some of that material to you today. But would you mind sharing with people a little bit your interest in Wisconsin Presbyterianism?
Yeah.
But also, I mean, you're kind of like this is jet setting, Midwest jet setting in research. You're all over the place doing some interesting work.
Well, my interest really began at a presbytery meeting where I asked a question that I knew the answer to. Our presbytery at that time was the Presbytery of the Midwest in its older, larger formulation. Yeah. We had had an archivist in the past, but we didn't have an archivist at that time. And I noticed that, and I asked the question, wouldn't it be good for us to have an archivist? And of course, the answer was yes. And of course, I was immediately appointed because you asked the question, you basically volunteered
for
the job.
That's how Presbyterianism works.
So I began getting involved in the archives of the Presbytery of the Midwest, worked on a project to digitize those archives so that we had them all in electronic form. And I started to read some of the minutes and some of the other documents, and the early minutes of the presbytery really captured my attention. And that drew me into research of a man, Arthur Perkins, who was the convener of the presbytery, the first moderator of the presbytery. And I did an extensive amount of research on him. And that took me up to Crescent Lake Bible Camp near Rhinelander. It took me to Merrill, the Merrill Historical Society. It took me down to St. Louis to the PCA Historical Society.
That's in Missouri, in case
That's
people are following.
And then I took two trips to the Presbyterian Historical Society in Philadelphia, which is the archive of the PCUSA. Mm-hmm. They were very nice. They were very willing to work with me. They provided materials that I couldn't have gotten anywhere else. It was a very pleasant experience. Obviously, different perspectives and different commitments there, but they facilitated the study. Well, as that project has gone on and developed into a book, which is in the final stages of editing at this point, I began looking at other Wisconsin Presbyterians. And as I dug into that, I found, number one, that there's a lot of resources, many of them available on the internet, but a wonderful library in Madison for the State Historical Society, and they have a ton of stuff, and other resources as well that I've picked up here, there, and everywhere. And the story of the beginnings of Presbyterianism in Wisconsin is as thrilling, as exciting as the story of Arthur Perkins, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's all sorts of Reformed history people might not be aware of regarding especially just Reformed theology in general in the Midwest. One book that I love a lot, and I can't say I've read all of it because it's enormous, but Netherlanders in America.
Oh, yes.
Yes, it's on the shelf over here somewhere, but a big fat book that's covering the history of Dutch immigration, and there's an enormous amount in there about their involvement in planting and establishing churches and denominations, or might we say confederations or federations. Yeah. But there's also some interesting overlap we'll get into a little bit later today regarding Presbyterianism. But people will be familiar with perhaps Grand Rapids as an enclave, or Holland. Maybe to some degree, South Holland in Illinois, Chicagoland. Yeah. There's also an interesting book called Dutch Chicago, which talks about some of this history. And then, of course, you get out into Iowa, like Pella, where there's, you know, every every version of Reformed or Presbyterian Reformed Church is available in Pella and then some.
Yeah.
And then some other satellite or might we say other settlements that were formed out of Pella for various reasons. But people aren't necessarily thinking about going up. They think about Grand Rapids and going around the lake, Michigan, into Chicago. But they don't always realize that settlement went up as well. And it was really significant. And that blends into the history of Presbyterianism.
Yeah. And, you know, this is something which is personally very interesting to me. I am a fully committed lifelong Presbyterian in my views.
Mm-hmm.
But I come from a Dutch Reformed background and heritage. Mm-hmm. My parents are both Dutch. My grandparents are all Dutch. And so
father was a CRC minister.
Right? Well, he was a CRC elder.
Elder.
Yeah.
But then eventually became an OP minister. Yeah. Okay.
And the blending of the Dutch and the Presbyterian is something which produces a distinctive flavor. It's not vanilla, it's French vanilla. It's not caramel, it's salted caramel. It's like it, but it's a bit different. And I find this interesting from my OP perspective because J. Gresham Machen had a similar appreciation for the blending of Presbyterianism and Dutch Reformed thought. And as he kind of constructed the faculty at Westminster, you have John Murray, who's obviously Scottish Presbyterian, and then you've got Machen, who's more kind of Southern Presbyterian.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you've got Van Til and Kuyper and Stonehouse and others who are all Dutch Reformed. And so there's this kind of meshing and blending of the heritage of both. And I think the theology of the Presbyterians is a bit more strong and consistent, and the sense of heritage and background in the Dutch Reformed is stronger. And so you have a very unique blend, which finds itself expressed in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, Sheboygan County. Now, something interesting I learned from that book that you mentioned is that Sioux Center, Iowa, Northwest Iowa, was kind of planted as a Dutch enclave by people from Sheboygan. So Sheboyganers traveled to Northwest Iowa. My grandparents live in Rock Valley, Iowa. I lived in Sioux Center for a number of years. And so Sioux Center is another one of those little Dutch enclaves.
Yep.
But it was Sheboygan that planted Sioux Center.
So it did not come out of Pella. It was Sheboyganers. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, the history there is fascinating. Something I've looked into and would like to look into even further regarding specifically OPC history. I really believe that the continental influence, particularly the Dutch influence, and then to some degree John Murray as a Scot, that saved the OPC from becoming an American cultural church. And I don't think it would have existed if it would have gone a different way in 1944, for example, with this famous thing called the Committee of Nine. We did a previous episode on that. I'll try to link to. But if Van Til and then his co-worker Murray Forrest Thompson weren't there filing that minority report, and then if there wasn't the Dutch influence among the assembly, especially with R.B. Kuyper and Ned Stonehouse, I think things would have gone entirely different. We would not be speaking about the OPC today. It would have either died or merged with something else that was cultural.
Well, and I think even earlier, the push in the OPC to make it a alcohol abstinence denomination, the Dutch wanted nothing to do with that.
Yeah, that's the backstory. Yep, yep.
And you've also got the push of the dispensational premillennial position to declare ourselves premillennial, and the Dutch influence is very much amillennial.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the Dutch end up being kind of a firewall from some of those American Presbyterian ideas.
They were called, not
to pat ourselves on the back too much.
No, the issue is here, I think the connection of the two is what makes it stronger. It's an amalgamation, is a fortifying, I think, where American Presbyterians need the helpful pushing and prodding and influence of the continental tradition.
Yeah.
to make it better and stronger against, you know, to fortify against its weaknesses.
Yeah.
Yet the continental tradition, often, and a lot of my continental friends or people that are in continental, historically continental churches would admit this and acknowledge it. The Continentals need the influence of the Presbyterian ecclesiology in the form of government because it can tend toward congregationalism, a form of connectionalism, but weaker than perhaps what Presbyterians hold to. So I think there's a healthy ecumenicity that makes both stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that was the case in the 20s and then leading up to 36 with the forming of the OPC and then 37 with the break off of the Bible Presbyterians.
Yeah.
Those Dutch antibodies saved the OPC from a lot of what I would see in hindsight as bad decisions. And then in 44, that was the deciding factor.
Yeah.
Really, would the OP be a cultural church? You know, kind of like Christian America or not. And thankfully it wasn't. But we have other challenges to deal with presently as well. So these Dutch antibodies have served us well, but that we see this influence not just in the 20th century, but going all the way back to at least the 19th. Mm-hmm. So who are some of the figures we want to talk about today and why are they significant?
Well, the story really, I think, begins with Jonathan Edwards, David Brainerd, a guy named John Sargent out in Massachusetts, ministering to an Indian tribe, which was very deeply influenced by the gospel. Well, these Indians were relocated first to New York and then to Wisconsin. And so really the first Reformed Christians in any significant number that came into Wisconsin was this Indian tribe. And they were located up just north of Appleton, which is a little bit to the southwest of Green Bay. So kind of central, north central Wisconsin. So a missionary came to minister among them named Jesse Minor. He served very well, was greatly appreciated, but he was only there for 4 or 5 years. And he died rather suddenly, and there was a gap. Meanwhile, there was another fellow out in the east named Cutting Marsh, who had been ordained as a missionary. He was going to go to the Sandwich Islands, but rather than that, he went to Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And he went to minister to American Indians.
And he needed some cheese for his sandwich.
That's right. Yeah. So he got to Wisconsin after kind of a convoluted trip to get there, and he immediately dove into ministry. This is 1834. And he began preaching and teaching and just doing the normal things that a church pastor would do. He was over their Sunday school program, you know, a lot of ordinary pastoral things. But he also had a great desire to reach out to the other Indian tribes in Wisconsin with the gospel. And so he had 4 or 5 assistants who were Indians from this tribe. And they went out on a missionary expedition to go to some of the more hostile tribes in central Wisconsin. There's really no indication that they had great success in doing that, but the impulse to be reaching out to very pagan, very violent, lost Indian tribes really kind of set something of the tone for Presbyterians in Wisconsin. There's going to be an emphasis on missions, on reaching the lost, and on reaching those outside of your own kind of cultural group.
Mm-hmm.
So he spent 16 or 18 years serving among these Indians, and he was very diligent, he was very thorough, but he became somewhat discouraged. He felt like they weren't really that responsive, that they hadn't left some of their cultural problems behind them. And so after serving there, he eventually resigned and he became kind of a missionary at large. And he traveled throughout the state, planting churches, encouraging young, small churches, and really being kind of like a home missionary.
Mm.
And he was involved in starting the first Presbyterian church in Wisconsin, which was in Green Bay. And then he was all
hurts. That just hurts me as a Bears fan to have the love of Presbyterianism.
Well,
and
here's a little
even the heathens
for
there
you.
can become Presbyterian.
So there's another minister, which I'll talk about in a minute, named Moses Ordway.
Yeah.
And when Ordway showed up in Green Bay, he reported what he saw. And he said the one thing that united the people of Green Bay was their desire to blaspheme God. And so every other night they would have these brawls, parties, orgies, I don't know what you would call them, where they would have a whiskey band and they would do very wicked things. Yeah. And by morning you've got all these drunken, besotted Wisconsins laying on the ground drunk. And he began preaching to these people. And through his ministry and also through Cutting Marsh, a church was established and it persisted. In fact, that church continues to exist today, although it's no longer a Presbyterian church. Mm. I believe it's a Methodist church. Mm. Mm-hmm. So they really started something which had some lasting power
Praise
to
God.
It. But
That's
they also did some things in Milwaukee. They got a church started in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. And Milwaukee kind of became the center for Presbyterian church activity in Wisconsin.
What's the history? I should know this. I probably did know this at one point. And I, you know, this morning, I'm just forgetting it. But the old Stockbridge Indians moved to Wisconsin, but yeah. We still have an effect there. There's an OPC church and a mission to the Menominee Indian tribe.
Yeah.
And those are descendants of the same tribe,
right?
Yeah. So the OPC does have a church among these same people in northern Wisconsin were previously ministered to, as you mentioned, by Jonathan Edwards and David Brainerd.
So Edwards and Brainerd and John Sargent, who is, you know, here's another figure that would be interesting to look more deeply into, a very strong Reformed Calvinist, did a lot of work in teaching the Indians, teaching them how to read. He established a school and really made them very literate people. So this tribe, as it moved from Massachusetts to New York and then to Wisconsin, mm-hmm. They were fairly happy being just north of Appleton. Then they moved kind of around Lake Winnebago to a town called Stockbridge.
Here we go.
And then they had a decision to make where they could either become U.S. citizens and stay on their farms in Stockbridge, or they could be relocated to Shawano County, which is to the west and a little bit to the north of Green Bay. And so the tribe split. Some of them took American citizenship. Some of them relocated.
And retained their identity as a distinct nation.
They retained their identity as a tribal nation.
Yeah.
So they live on the reservation in Shawano County. In the 30s, Arthur Perkins, along with another man named Harold Hillegas, were traveling from Merrill to Shawano to be doing ministry there. And they were evangelizing and discipling the Indians. So for 5 years, Perkins and Hillegas were making that trip. And, you know, this is the 1930s, cars and roads being different from what they are now. It was a significant commitment. Mm. So they did a thorough job of ministering there. In 1936, the new Presbytery of Wisconsin and Upper Michigan appointed the first missionary to the Indians, which was John Davies. Mm-hmm. And John Davies stayed there for several decades and had a very, very fruitful ministry. There were hundreds of Indians involved in the ministry there. So Davies stayed there for quite some time, and then he left. Others came and went. And we still do have two OP works among the Indians. The old Stockbridge Church is closed or soon to be closed because the membership has just aged and is no longer functioning. And the Zohar work among the Menominees has been sidelined by the COVID shutdowns.
Yeah.
And so now in Shawano, we have Reverend Gordon Oliver and a church there, which is kind of picking up the slack. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from Jesse Minor in 1825 to today, we have been carrying on ministry among those Indian tribes.
Yeah. Praise God. Curious here, you know, it's, you mentioned the presbytery at that time early on as the Presbytery of Wisconsin, and then includes Upper Michigan. Yeah. And that was true for the Presbytery of the Midwest even before you split. And your presbytery now does also include the UP.
Yeah.
We don't have any churches or works there.
Yeah.
I realize there are historical reasons for this, because Michigan was founded in 1837, or became a state in 1837. Wisconsin became a state in 1848. But the fact that the UP, if you look at the geography, the fact that the UP isn't Wisconsin just tells me a lot about the attitude of Wisconsinites. Yeah. That, how come you haven't taken that over?
I don't know. We need a militia to invade the UP. Hot take.
So, yeah, hot take. That's going to go on Twitter here in a minute, or whatever, Instagram, TikTok, whatever. So we mentioned several figures here, but I don't. How should we enter into this? Because all of this has to do with the history of Presbyterianism. But you mentioned Cutting Marsh or Moses Ordway. Do you want to dive in to more specifics on any of these figures?
Let me talk a bit more about Ordway, because he's such an interesting guy. So he was just living a normal life, growing up in his parents' home, and a revival came to his community, and he was converted. And he saw people just living carelessly in their sin. And he determined that he would be a minister and go preach the gospel. His father, who was an uneducated man, was very much against Moses doing this, but his mother really encouraged him. And so he was trained, he was ordained, and looking for a place to be of use to the Lord. Well, in his growing up, he was taught many things by his father, including mechanical things. Mm. And he was very gifted in terms of construction, in terms of devising mechanical operations, things
like
this.
Does his dad want him to go into those trades?
Right, right. And his dad did that kind of work.
Yeah.
So, you know, his dad is teaching him, and Moses picks this up. He's very handy in many different ways. So he comes to Wisconsin, and he establishes the church in Green Bay. He then relocates down to Milwaukee and spends some time in Milwaukee. He got a homestead, and he went back east and brought his family back, and they were on this homestead, and he began preaching, and it was in Waukesha.
Yeah.
And so he's preaching there and gathering groups of people, and not just in Waukesha, but in another town called Troy. And he's very aggressive in this, and he doesn't take money for his services. This is really uncommon. And so he establishes these works and gets them up and running. And then as soon as they're mature enough, he hands them off to some minister who is looking for a call.
Is he getting in? Because he's also pitching money in himself toward things.
Yes.
Is he making money through trades? Is he doing tent making? Or where's the money coming from?
I have no idea. I don't think he was independently wealthy, but I do think that he was so gifted at commercial things that making money was not difficult for him to do. So, yeah, he's contributing to the financial support of other ministers.
Right.
And then he moves off and begins planting a church in some new community. And he's just kind of leapfrogging all over the place in that central part of Wisconsin.
Building even worship houses for people.
Yeah. I've got a quote here. Let me see if I can find this, where he talks about his approach, because it's just so, I mean, I find it hilarious the way he talks about it. Let's see. Oh, yeah, here it is. Okay. He says, I would look for a place where the people were so poor, stupid, or heartless that they would not ask a minister to preach to them and would take pains to say that they would not be able to pay as a gentle hint to let you to you to let them alone. In such a place, I delighted to put my foot. I never preached to them the love of Christ to harden them for a long siege, but began with St. Paul's doctrines, and very soon there would be a new face on things. As soon as they were awake and God began to increase them and they began to want to pay me, I would open the door for some anxious minister who is ready for work and I would go to another place.
I love it.
I just love that. You know, he's looking for hard places to do ministry where people don't want him there.
Right.
And he goes and he preaches not this kind of soft, mushy message of, oh, God loves you. He's telling them, you're sinners and God is full of wrath against sinners and you need to repent and, right. you know, preaching St. Paul's doctrines until they're finally awake.
It's kind of, you know, analogous to the ministry of John the Baptist. He's kind of preparing a way for another minister, of course, not on the same level at all, but it is a unique type of ministry.
Yeah.
But to have an attitude like that and a persistence, he sounds like he'd be a fun guy to have lunch with sometime just to pick his brain.
Yeah. Well, and he went to Beaver Dam, and I think he kind of settled in Beaver Dam.
Mm-hmm.
And while he was in Beaver Dam, I mean, when he got there, it was just this thick forest. And, you know, right now, central Wisconsin doesn't have thick forests. It has occasional trees, but nothing thick.
It's all been cleared.
So, yeah, he comes into a place which is basically virgin territory, and he builds a town.
Mm-hmm.
He plots out all of the roads that lead into and out of Beaver Dam, and he builds it up into kind of a social and commercial center. And he's preaching the gospel, and he's establishing a church, and he's actually building things like grist mills for the people. And he does all of this on his own dime, which kind of brings back the question, where's the money coming from? But he seems to be able to just make money, and then he uses that money for God's kingdom, which, you know, again, how many people today don't just say, if I'm going to make it, I'm going to keep it, rather than I'm going to make it so I can use it to advance the kingdom of Christ.
Yeah, he's engaged in the early 19th century form of like social enterprise. You know, and I read this book about 20 years ago called Great Commission Companies. And it was kind of this idea of like having a private company, but also organizing it so that you're plowing its profits into, you know, a worthwhile endeavor.
Yeah, yeah.
There are different, even today, different legal ways to incorporate like a 503B company or something like 403B, whatever. Anyway, praise God that there are people like that doing that. And he's an interesting example of somebody who not only was donating his funds, but also working directly and engaging in the work of the ministry in addition to all of the hands-on work he was doing.
Well, and again, you know, as with Cutting Marsh, there's a real commitment to missions, not just foreign missions, but home missions and church planting. And there was a entrepreneurial spirit in Moses Ordway, where he wanted to go places, not just to make a name for himself, but to establish preaching stations, which would turn into church plants. And through that kind of aggressive church planting ministry, central Wisconsin was populated with Presbyterian churches.
My.
So,
well, to sneak another Bears reference in, we need to have some sort of like Wisconsin home church planting entrepreneurial group. And we could call it the Monsters of the Ordway. I like this. We're going to doing the hard work, going to the hard people, and building them buildings and breaking them down day by day until they want to minister. And then we leave.
Yeah, then we leave.
And then we send someone else to go.
Yeah,
later.
One of the people kind of commenting on Ordway after his life was over called him an uncompromising Calvinist and a Presbyterian zealot.
Yeah.
And I think we need more uncompromising Calvinists who are also Presbyterian zealots.
Yes. Yes. In the greatest sense. Yeah. I love it. I think we need that as well. I'm going to be maximalists about all these types of things, because the thought is in church planting, especially and foreign missions, but church planting today, it's, you know, it's almost like looking for the new measures, you know, let's contextualize things. Yeah. We need to meet people where they are, but we need to form and fashion this church so that it's attractive to people rather than Ordway. If Ordway went to a home missions conference, like an evangelical home missions conference, this guy would be kicked to the curb faster, you know, than anyone else.
Well, yeah, it's appreciating the fact that the gospel is an offense to those who are lost, and the offense of the gospel needs to be placed in front of people.
Mm-hmm.
So that they are not manipulated into some sort of connection to the church, but they need to face the realities. They're sinners. They need a savior. Without Christ, they have nothing. They have no hope.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Ordway and Marsh are doing that. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're really confronting lost men with the gospel. Now, there's someone else that deserves maybe some attention, too, and this is a guy named Stephen Pete.
Mm-hmm.
And he's important for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that he wrote kind of the definitive history of early Wisconsin Presbyterians. And his book, let me get the title for it here.
I wonder if that's on Google Books.
Yeah, it is. It is. Okay, History of the Presbyterian and Congregational Churches and Ministers in Wisconsin, including an account of the organization of the convention and the plan of union. That's by Stephen Pete, published by
those good Puritan titles.
Silas Chapman of Milwaukee in 1851. So this is like original source material. And that volume is available on the internet, which is wonderful to just be able to find an electronic copy of it and click, and there it is on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
But Stephen Pete was also a very important figure. He was ordained in Ohio. He came to Wisconsin originally. He stopped in Milwaukee. He was invited to preach at that church in Green Bay, and he did. The people were so impressed with his preaching that they immediately called a congregational meeting that morning after the service.
Wow.
Which in our book of church order, you couldn't do that. No 10 days notice. So they called a congregational meeting while he's still there, and they voted to extend him a call, and he accepted it. So he traveled back east to get his family, brings his family, and spends 2 years in Green Bay. And while he's in Green Bay, he does some traveling. He travels basically the length and breadth of the Wisconsin territory, and he's very impressed with the beauty of Wisconsin. So,
is this the brother who said it was a heaven on earth?
Yes.
Yes.
So he begins publicizing this in magazines on the East Coast, and he's basically a one-man welcome wagon to get people to come to Wisconsin. Because Wisconsin at that point was not heavily populated. They needed immigration from the East and from the South. So his very rosy, promising descriptions of Wisconsin, its natural beauty, the richness of the soil, et cetera, helps to encourage the wave of immigration that takes place in the 1840s and the 1850s. Now, a lot of those immigrants came with settled commitments ecclesiastically. Some of them were Presbyterians, some of them were Lutherans, some of them were Roman Catholics, and they wanted their churches established in their new homes. So Pete began establishing and encouraging ministers to come, Presbyterian ministers to come and fill these pulpits in these new churches. So he's very involved statewide and really throughout the nation. They had this idea of having a plan of union. And you guys may have done a program on the plan of union.
Yeah, usually when we hear that in Presbyterianism, we, especially us old schoolers, we get yeah, all upset.
It's really not the greatest idea, but I do think it had, at least in Wisconsin, some admirable
sure
impulses. So they decided to kind of link arms with the Congregationalists because at that time, theological differences weren't nearly so great. And the Congregationalists were viewed as different in their polity, but not necessarily in their doctrine. So in Wisconsin, they had this convention that was set up where churches could join in and be part of the convention, and they could retain their governmental commitments. So Presbyterian churches who were part of the convention still functioned as Presbyterians. Mm. The Congregationalists could still be congregational. And yet they were trying to work cooperatively and not competitively. This was, I think, an effort to try and minister to the population of the state, especially with so many immigrants coming in a way that it's not petty and competitive like sometimes we see even today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a good impulse, but it very quickly broke down. Stephen Pete was at the center of this thing, and he became basically the agent that controlled it. He was the clerk of the convention, and he basically ran the convention. And when the convention started to fall apart, Pete was the one that was criticized for it. So publications out east were saying Stephen Pete is the problem, and the reason this is going so badly is because of Stephen Pete. If we could just get rid of Stephen Pete. Well, eventually they drove him to the point where he resigned.
Hmm.
He went off. He was in Beloit for a while, and then he came down to Chicago, and he actually played on the Chicago Bears. Oh, no, different story.
My brother goes to minor league baseball games in Beloit, and their team is called the Skycarp, which is a regional term for geese, particularly geese that don't migrate.
Oh, my. So, I don't want to go there. But Stephen Pete did help start a theological school in Chicago, a seminary in Chicago, and then he died. But his contribution was really to see a broad vision for the whole territory for church planting. He wanted to see the church planted throughout Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Now, from 1836, when Cutting Marsh and Moses Ordway organized the church in Green Bay, to 1936, a 100-year period of time, they went from having one church in Green Bay to having over 200 Presbyterian churches throughout all parts of Wisconsin. And in 1936, there were five PCUSA presbyteries covering the entire state, and there were churches everywhere in Wisconsin.
Mm.
Now, you know, the big players in Wisconsin ecclesiastical history are really the Roman Catholics and secondarily the Lutherans. But that's largely, I think, because there was so much immigration. You know, Germans and Irish moving in became the Catholic population. Mm-hmm. And yet Presbyterians were right there in the thick of things. And they were doing their stuff, maybe on a smaller scale, but not an insignificant scale. Which led me to the conviction, which is growing, that Wisconsin was really an important player in Presbyterianism. You know, you can look at Philadelphia as kind of the heart of Presbyterianism in the U.S. That's true. The Carolinas, there was a lot of Presbyterian influence in the Carolinas. You think about the Midwest, and Wisconsin doesn't jump to mind.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm convinced that Wisconsin was very important, more important than Illinois and Iowa and Missouri and Michigan and Indiana. Really, Wisconsin was much more Presbyterian than any of the other Midwestern states. And so it has played a really significant role in the development of Midwestern Presbyterianism.
Sure. There's no doubt about it. I mean, it's wonderful to know that. When we look at Illinois, for example, you know, if you go south of Chicagoland, there's not much going on Presbyterian wise. Obviously, there are a lot of mainline churches around, but in terms of NAEPARC, it is sparse and it's depressing. I mean, it shouldn't be. We should look to the Lord and realize that He would provide, but things are a lot different in Wisconsin, and I think that has a lot to do with the history and who settled up there and the labors of many of these men planting churches and cultivating them. Who else do we have? We got Stephen Pete here, but you also mentioned in the Sunday school, Peter Zona, somebody that we've mentioned before on this program, maybe about almost 10 years ago, 9 or 10 years ago, one of the deacons at Hope, where I serve as a minister, Brian Winter, spoke with me, and he's done quite a bit of research on this figure, an interesting, mysterious figure.
Yeah, and I think his role is very important as well, especially for Sheboygan County, but really for southeastern Wisconsin. So at the time, I would commend that episode to your listeners. Mm-hmm. That's a really helpful episode. But around that time, there was an organized effort in southwestern Michigan to recruit people from the Netherlands to southwestern Michigan, to Holland, and then to Grand Rapids. And a similar organization was working out of Pella, Iowa, recruiting Dutchmen to come to Pella. There was no organization like that for Wisconsin. And there wasn't really the connections or even the idea of doing that kind of a organized recruiting effort. But Zona came to the Milwaukee area, and he was serving there an independent Dutch Reformed church. And there was a catastrophe that took place just off the coast of Sheboygan when a ship that was carrying immigrants caught fire at night, and most of the passengers died. Some of them made it to shore. And the Phoenix, that was the name of the ship, became the start of a Dutch presence in the Sheboygan County area. So the survivors of the Phoenix had been headed for Western Michigan. Here they are, kind of stranded in Wisconsin, and they contacted the authorities in Michigan to say, can we affiliate with you? And the word they got back was, no, that's too far. We don't have the connections. You should affiliate with the Presbyterians. So they're being pushed in the direction of the Presbyterians. Well, down in Milwaukee, once the Phoenix catastrophe has hit, there's a committee that's established of ministers to serve the needs of these victims of this crisis. And Zona was on the committee, and it's on that committee that he got his first acquaintance with a Presbyterian minister, and that was apparently a positive connection. Well, Zona took a group of immigrants up to the area which is called Cedar Grove, and it's right in the corner of Sheboygan County, and he established a church there and began ministry there. As he is carrying out what was a very thriving ministry, he determined that it was time to affiliate, and he chose to affiliate with the Presbyterians. He felt like the doctrinal commitments of the Presbyterians were strong and that it was a safe home for them. Not everybody agreed with that.
Yeah.
And could you imagine Dutch people disagreeing with their minister? Well,
how much is this going to cost?
Some of them were so upset that they pulled this little stunt.
This is crazy. Yeah.
And this is just, you can't make this stuff up. Three of them go to the church with axes to break into the church and to conduct their own worship service.
Right.
Which is really a setup to get Zona entrapped.
Mm-hmm.
So they break into the church, and they are—
Zona lives on the property.
Yeah, right? He lives like right next to the church. So he hears what's going on.
Right.
And they're in the building, and one of them's in the pulpit, and the other two are in a pew. And as soon as they see him coming across to confront them, they start their worship service. Yeah, it's a really holy worship service there. And he gives them the business.
Prepare your axe for worship.
Tosses them out of the building.
Yeah.
And does it with some force. And they go stomping off to find the constable to arrest him for violating a law that said you cannot interrupt a worship service in progress.
Right.
He gets arrested. There's a criminal trial. There's a civil action that he brings. And it's just the kind of hard-headed, cantankerous Dutch way. Adding some snarl to the polite Presbyterian approach.
Uh-huh.
And the Dutch in Sheboygan County still continue to be a fairly independent-minded group of people.
Mm.
And that comes from their heritage and their connection to Zona, I think.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, then through Zona, that church became, I should put it this other way. John DeWard became the pastor of that church, right, in Cedar Grove, and that is the church that you walked out of.
Yeah.
Significantly in 36.
They affiliated with the Presbyterians, so it became First Presbyterian Church in Cedar Grove.
Mm-hmm.
And DeWard was the pastor there when all the modernism started coming out.
Right.
And he led the people out of that church to form Calvary OPC,
mm-hmm,
which exists today.
Yep.
So
right there in town.
Yeah.
So yeah, that famous story for the OPCers who know it, John J. DeWard significantly preached this last sermon, even though a member of Presbytery was there. There's a whole backstory to this on what they were doing to DeWard, and it was just not right.
Yeah.
And there was a representative of Presbytery there basically to tell the congregation that John DeWard was no longer their pastor. And he, at one point, was trying to prevent DeWard from preaching and stole his notes.
Yeah.
And so DeWard went back to his office and grabbed an earlier version, committed to, and then finally preached his final sermon. And then he walked out because he, had been removed from the pulpit,
yeah,
officially by the presbytery, and went out with his family, but about 300 people also walked out with him. He wasn't intending to create this staged event, but it ended up being that way. And then they eventually formed the OP congregation.
Yeah, and that congregation and the one in Oostburg, just a little north of there,
Oscar Holkbor,
were really important for the new presbytery. Mm-hmm. The congregation in Oostburg, Bethel, didn't immediately join the new presbytery, but Cedar Grove did. Calvary was, I believe, the second church in the new presbytery. So, there's a presbytery connection here too, which I want to speak about a little bit. When the OPC was forming, it was very small and very scattered. There was a concentration in the Philadelphia area, and there were other pockets around on the East Coast. There was some activity out in California, but in terms of having a well-defined approach for home missions, there really wasn't anything. And even the question of how do you establish a new presbytery was kind of foggy. So at the First General Assembly on June 11, 1936, the Presbytery of Philadelphia was erected by the denomination so that ministers would have a presbytery to be part of. They had to have somewhere to put the ministers. So the Presbytery of Philadelphia is erected in early June of 36. As soon as Arthur Perkins gets back from the assembly, he's asking Dr. Machen, when can we start a presbytery out here in Wisconsin and how do we do that? And Machen really wasn't able to handle those types of questions, so he passed it to Edwin Ryan, who is not the most famous figure in our history, not most beloved maybe, but important at the time.
A dubious history.
And Ryan was the General Secretary for Home Missions at that point. So Ryan began corresponding with Perkins about the idea of how do you set up a new presbytery. And Perkins asked very specifically, can you send us guidelines for how to do this? And basically what Ryan sent him were some papers that showed what another group was doing that maybe could serve as something of a boilerplate for Wisconsin. The group, the Home Missions Committee voted to establish the Wisconsin Presbytery and to appoint Perkins to be the convener. That happened in early July 36. And so Perkins then in late July has a convening meeting of the presbytery, and he's elected the first moderator. He is also elected at that point as the chairman of the Home Missions Committee, which was made up of every single member of the new presbytery. So the whole presbytery is on the Home Missions Committee. Perkins is the chairman, and Perkins is appointed as the field secretary. Now, part of the thinking here was that Perkins had done for 7 years home missions work in the PCUSA. He was extremely effective at that, very, very successful. And he knew how to run a home missions operation. So he was offering his services to not just the new presbytery, but to the denominational committee that I'd be glad to work with you to set up new presbyteries and new churches, not only in Wisconsin, but throughout the Middle West and the West. So he's willing to be like covering half the country. And the Home Missions Committee through Edwin Ryan are very pleased with that offer. And they're counting on him to help them because he knows what he's doing. He's done this before. He was very effective previously. So they look to him and they say very clearly, we need your help on this. But then he begins to suffer a mental breakdown, a nervous breakdown, they called it. And as he is beginning to decline, Ryan is very concerned. In fact, he tells Perkins, you need to listen to your doctor. You need to go to bed and get the rest and refreshment you need. And when he further declines and ends up in a sanitarium, they're extremely concerned because he is the one person they've got who really knows how to do this stuff. And they said, we're looking to you to help us in this. Well, as his decline gets deeper and deeper, he is brought up for prayer at the Second General Assembly because they realize it looks like we're going to lose Perkins, and Perkins is going to be irreplaceable. So when Perkins dies, it was not as widely publicized or maybe as broadly traumatic as Machen's death, but it was damaging to the home missions efforts that the OPC was really trying to pursue. And so now they've lost their most experienced person in home missions, and who do you replace them with? You don't just have people like that who are going to step up and say, well, you know, I've done home missions for the last 7 years. So the Midwest, and especially Wisconsin and Perkins in particular, played a really crucial role in the first 6 months of the OPC. And his loss really was quite a blow.
Mm. Wow. That's an important connection. Perkins shares a lot of characteristics with some of these other folks from Wisconsin. What are some of your takeaways,
yeah,
you know, in terms of the history of Presbyterianism in Wisconsin? What similar themes do you find? And yeah, I guess here's the question, what is the constitution or the makeup of these yeah, folks from Wisconsin?
Well, I think there's a can-do attitude among early Wisconsin Presbyterians. And I think you're right. There's a lot of things about Perkins that are very similar to Cutting Marsh and even Moses Ordway. They don't sit around waiting for someone to tell them what to do. They take initiative. There's an entrepreneurial attitude among these early Wisconsin Presbyterians. And, you know, we want to be careful here because the entrepreneurial stuff, the business model, can become very detrimental to the church. I'm not saying we should follow best business practices and for how we run the church. The church is not a business. It's not a corporation. Mm-hmm. But that entrepreneurial spirit where it says, we've got a job to do. How do we do this? How mm-hmm. do we do it efficiently? How do we do it cost effectively? How do we do it so that it is a lasting thing and not just a flash in the pan? And I think these early Presbyterians in Wisconsin were very committed to that. And it's because of that that they traveled so extensively and went around preaching and teaching wherever they had an opportunity to. Cutting Marsh would ride his horse around the state, and he would stop in homes. He would stop in like halls. There might be a hall above a pub, eating establishment. Wherever he could find people, he would go and he would minister. He would preach the gospel. Sometimes he would even act as a doctor at the sick bed, prescribing medicine for people who didn't have maybe the means or the opportunity to get medical care. And that kind of initiative seems to me to be lacking a lot today. It's almost as if we're waiting for something to fall into our laps. And until it falls into our laps, we're not going to stir ourselves much to do it. You know, I think about, it's a little bit of a soapbox. I think about the northern half of Wisconsin, basically from Green Bay over to Minneapolis, St. Paul, that whole northern half of the state. Now, granted, there's not a ton of people up there. It's not heavily populated, but it is full of small towns and full of some mid-sized towns. Like I think of the town of Ashland is a significant town up there. There's really no Reformed or Presbyterian churches up there. So what are we going to do about that? Are we just going to wait for people to contact us and say, oh, I live in Ashland and I want to start an OP church now? I don't think that that's very realistic. We'll be waiting a long time and our phones will not be ringing. I think we have to take that entrepreneurial initiative to say, what can we do to establish churches, a network of churches throughout the northern half of Wisconsin? And then you mentioned the Upper Peninsula. There's nothing in the Upper Peninsula church-wise. What are we going to do about that? And these people said, you know what? Home missions is a priority. It's an important commitment that we've got. And they're energy in doing church planting was just enormous. So, you know, I think that's a real significant takeaway. But I also think that the commitment to ministering to the Indians was very commendable. It would be easy to write off the Indians as, you know, hopeless pagan savages. And in those days, maybe that attitude was more commonly shared by a lot of people because, you know, there was a lot of strife between the Indian tribes and the white settlers. And there was, you know, back and forth where neither side trusted each other. And yet Cutting Marsh says, let me get some of these Christian Indians and let's go travel to these tribes. Let's go to the brother towns. They're very hostile. They're very violent. They're very dangerous. They need the gospel. Let's go to them with the gospel at some personal risk. And, you know, that kind of commitment to cross-cultural ministry. Now, in our day, cross-cultural ministry may not be exclusive to Native Americans living on reservations. What about the Hispanic community in a city like Milwaukee? What do we do about church planting in the Hispanic community? How do we reach the Hispanics in southeastern Wisconsin? You know, there's lots and lots of cross-cultural ministry opportunities, but are we awake and alive to them? You know, when Cutting Marsh was doing his work, he was very realistic about how difficult it was, but he was very ready to tackle it, to give it his all. And that kind of a model of cross-cultural ministry, I think, really challenges me a lot.
Yeah, That's useful. That's helpful. I hope that encourages people. It also motivates people that are listening, not only in the presbyteries and people that are familiar with what's going on, but people from outside. Maybe people might be raised up or called to move or to consider taking up ministerial work or whatever the case may be. But there's a need and there's a lot of opportunity.
One of my seminary professors, who is a very colorful man, used to talk about something he called the constipated Calvinist. And what he meant by that was people who have all of the bona fides of Calvinistic doctrine, but don't really care about outreach, who aren't really applying it in terms of seeking to save the lost through the preaching of the gospel. And, you know, it doesn't do a lot of good if you are theologically accurate and correct, but you're not willing to proclaim the gospel of Christ to those who are lost and dead in their sins. And I've always thought that that's a really great challenge, because we tend to be pretty satisfied with our own theological precision. And we can talk amongst ourselves, and we can further refine our formulations so that they are excessively correct. But what about that next door neighbor who is living a life of careless debauchery, who doesn't really ever give a thought to his soul and what happens when he dies? What are we going to do about him? You know, is it really enough to say, but I've memorized the Westminster Confession of Faith? If we're not really reaching the lost, have we lost something of the genius of the Reformation? You know, another topic which I could go on for a long time on, actually I've written a booklet on this, Calvin and the Mission of the Church. And I did this when I was in seminary. I looked into Calvin and his involvement in what we would call missions. And what I found was it was much more thoroughgoing than anything I anticipated. If you're really Reformed, but you don't care about outreach, are you really Reformed?
Mm.
I would say no.
Yeah. Helpful reminders. That's really important. People can come visit Wisconsin. They can head right on over
to heaven on earth.
To Sheboygan. And the church is right there, real easy to get to. And there's a lot of other churches, wonderful folks up in Wisconsin. So if you're ever passing on through, and there's great places to go visit, all sorts of good things to go do and see. So you can find all that through the regular outlets online. I'll have links to various things in the episode description. We are available online as well at reformedforum.org if you haven't been there already. But if you want to get in touch with us or follow up, or if you have any questions or anything of the sorts, then we have a forum or email address. Everything's available online. We look forward to further conversations and other discussions on interesting topics in Presbyterian and Reformed history, both in the United States and abroad. But I do want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.